Channel 9 Live. I'm here with Ray Ozzie. It's really fun. My name is Jeff Sandquist, and we do this little Channel 9 thing on my team. And this is really fun, Ray. You know, the very first time I met you was at a PDC. You didn't work at Microsoft. And I think it was over some Mexican food and a few beers at some restaurant here. Do you remember that?
I think it was a pretty heavy night, and I don't think I remember anything from that night.
It was a good time. So, you know, it's really interesting when you think about it. You've came to PDCs as an attendee. Mm-hmm. You've came to PDCs, you know, as a customer and all sorts of things.
Absolutely.
Talk to me a little bit about what you would recommend to people as they come to an event like this.
Man, PDC is a very unique event. I was just telling a reporter earlier, this is one of the most significant events of any kind that I had been to, just simply because every developer, every attendee gets to play reporter, gets to play the same game that reporters do in terms of going around and asking the same question of 5, 6, 7, 8 Microsoft employees to see what the story really is, mm-hmm. Because you can't spin that many people. So, you know, there's the message that we like to deliver in terms of strategy, mm-hmm. but then when you're really talking to people on the ground, to every developer, you can make your own assessment of what are the platforms that we're betting on, what are the APIs that you know really count, what are other groups inside Microsoft mm-hmm. betting on. It's just a unique opportunity to get that face time with the
And the unique thing for you is some of the roles you played, you came as a partner, as a competitor, and now as the CSA. So, you know, so different types of roles that you had to go do that.
And what I miss, honestly, is the interaction, because, you know, I spend a lot of time doing this, but, you know, in actual fact, it's the interaction with developers and with customers and partners that's just so valuable.
So this is kind of neat, you know, with the power of the internet and so forth. We're here live, we're in front mm-hmm. of a studio audience here, all sorts of people around this. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we have tens of thousands of people watching online. And one of the things I want to do is remind people through Twitter, you know, send out a tweet to @CH9Live, and by doing that, we can go through and ask your questions, and they'll come up on there on the monitor, and we'll bring those up. So while we're waiting for those to start coming through for you, you know, it's 4 years ago, you sent out a memo to the company about services disruptions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you think that Microsoft's doing and progressing towards, you know, talk a little bit about that vision and how we're doing to progress towards doing to that?
That was a very interesting time, and I was trying to send a number of messages in that memo. There was a section at the beginning related to the transformation of business models, you know, toward advertising. I think most of that memo focused on the transformation of the programming model and the experience. The fact that, now we call it three screens in a cloud. I used, you know, perhaps different words at the time, but I was basically talking about how we need to transform every experience, whether it's productivity, media, entertainment, and so on, repivot them from thinking about it as the PC as delivery device to being independent of delivery device and thinking of how is it best delivered on phone, how is it best delivered on web, how is it best delivered on PC, and more recently we're talking also about TV. I think one of the things that's transformed greatly since those days is that even though in internal presentations I was focused also on the back end, that really wasn't that present in that memo very much. But now, a lot of what we're talking about here at the show, you can see over there. Sorry, the viewers can't see it, but we've got a container, an Azure container live there. People are thinking a lot more about that, the back end of the computing model, and it's tremendous. I never would have thought that at this point in time, you know, it would have this much of a vigorous following.
And it's really the early days of the cloud, right? And so when you think about it, you know, what can we imagine for the, you know, 3 to 5 years from now? You know, what kind of things do you see then?
Yeah, I think the reason that I feel like it's early days is in essence, we don't have a broad suite of frameworks, you know, that in essence we're lacking the code to cut and paste from to give us the full benefits of the cloud. If you look at Amazon and VMware and a number of other vendors out there, They're primarily focused on taking existing workloads from the enterprise and moving them up into the cloud more or less as is. Azure does that, but it was really designed also to be kind of a cloud OS for the next 20, 30 years. And what I mean by that is we envision this as being the platform where people begin by thinking, how do I build my app in a horizontally scalable fashion? What is the right way to factor the different roles inside the service so that, you know, the front-end roles scale a certain way, the mid-tiers scale a certain way, the database servers scale a certain way. And we really don't have a lot of you know, apps that are out there that are, you know, kind of archetypes for high-scale services. Certainly every one of us, you know, whether it's Google or Bing, Hotmail, you know, Yahoo, these are very, very high-scale services, but there aren't many, you know, sample apps and frameworks that are ready-made for that environment. And we'll get there. We will get there over time.
So you talk about three screens in a cloud, mm-hmm. and, you know, meaning PC and phone and TV. Let's talk a little bit about the takeaways for developers as they're thinking about, you know, building applications that target, you know, these different vehicles.
Well, the reason we say three screens in a cloud is not there are going to be exactly three screens. You know, we can argue, are there four, are there five? You know, the reason we say three is that there, from an experience perspective, there's, I think we can all agree, there's going to be a form factor that's a pocket or purse form factor. There's going to be a form factor that's largely intended for desktops or most comfortable on desktops or on our laps with a keyboard. And then there's going to be a larger form factor on our wall. This could be a TV. It could be a large screen in a conference room. We basically feel that from the perspective of a given experience, a presentation experience, let's say, there are going to be ways to present those in conference rooms, on the desktop, and on the phone that might be slight variants or big variants of one another, but they'll all still work together very, very seamlessly, brought together by the cloud. And of course, there's also a browser instantiation of those scenarios that might be delivered in a browser on a phone, a browser mm-hmm. on the desktop, and so on. The reason we say there might be more is, of course, there are also embedded devices, and what roles do those play? At the highest level, though, is really the highest level notion that we should always think first about the solution value that we're trying to create or deliver, and then say, how is that best rendered on the desktop, on the phone, or on this inherently shared canvas on the wall?
So I'm a big person about data. I love data. John Udell is somebody who's really, you know, talked to me about the importance of doing great things with data. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Dallas mm-hmm. and explain a little bit about that and the significance of what we announced this morning around that.
Well, Dallas, for those of you who didn't have a chance to read about it yet, is it's a component within a larger marketplace that we have called Pinpoint, and it's really focused on data, and it's about bringing data sets together, whether it's databases or data sets together, with a common way to represent that data, to expose data sets to developers, a common licensing model, in essence to bring all the benefits of marketplaces to data. Right now data is in many different forms, different vendors, commercial or public data, such as the data at data.gov. There's a lot of data out there, but it's formatted differently. Sometimes there's a corporate licensing model, sometimes there's a per-user licensing model, and in essence, each one of those represents some type of friction. What Dallas does is it brings together, it puts certain guardrails around the data experience for developers and says that there, and posits that there will be more innovation if we can consume data, discover data, you know, combine it in different ways through this kind of marketplace. Now, we don't set the pricing or things like that. We're just trying to basically at this point say, here's an interface, here's a way of plugging things in as a service provider, and here's a way of consuming it as an app developer, and I think a lot of exciting things are going to emerge.
It's a really interesting differentiator between us and the things that we're doing with the platform. Maybe talk a little bit about some of the other things that you feel differentiates us between the competitors that are out there in around with Windows Azure.
I think the biggest thing with Windows Azure is something that I was commenting on earlier with respect to the way that we conceptualized it when building it. Certainly the easiest way to conceptualize cloud computing is to take an existing VM and just upload it to the cloud. But you know, at a high level, I like to think of every one of our apps as a composition of different aspects. And I think if we have frameworks and break them up like that, you can submit them into Azure and have Azure deploy them in an appropriate way. So, for example, the front ends of a given app might be pushed to be more closely geolocated to where the users are. The mid-tier might be closer to where the data is. So maybe you have the data for a given app or solution concentrated in a set of data centers or a data center in North America, but you might have front end roles that are that are more spread out across the world, that are even closer to where the content is at the CDNs. And Azure was designed for this more or less horizontal programming model from the start.
That's great. So we've been asking for questions out via at CH9 Live, and we've got a few here that we'd like to bring. C. Kurt, do the three screens need to run Windows in your vision, or will some content delivery services be platform independent?
No, the three screens don't need to run Windows. You know, we believe in a world that is a broad variety of devices. You know, embedded devices at one end of the spectrum. You know, without screens. That there are devices that are out there right now. Sony makes one that you can carry along with you that keeps a track of your GPS coordinates. At any given point in time, there are a broad variety of devices. I just bought this. The scale called, I think it was from We Things mm-hmm. or Y Things, that it's just a bathroom scale, but it happens to upload data as a side effect of just getting on the scale. These things don't have to all be running Windows. However, I do believe that for developers such as here at PDC, there's tremendous leverage in terms of bringing your programming skills from one platform to the next, and we believe that on our devices that we will deliver the richest experience with a common programming model. You'll get the greatest skills leverage and the best experience on Windows devices. But the world is full of choice, and especially in collaborative or interactive apps, you can't control what someone else's choices are. So many apps and solutions have to be cross-platform at birth.
So I'm not sure how to pronounce this name, if that the X is silent, but XOSTAERE. Will a fat cloud mean a thin client going forward?
I don't really believe in the notion of a thin client. If you look at what every client is at this point, there is some degree of fatness in everything. The browser itself has become tremendously rich in terms of its being a runtime, and it's hard to build a purely thin client, let's say, out of TTL circuitry at this point in time. You put a processor in it, you put memory in it, you put a runtime in it, so it becomes thick to some degree. At a very high level, what I believe is that we write software, and we should use the devices, the capability of the devices that's at our disposal to deliver the richest possible experience. If this device, there's a device sitting right here that has a that looks like a monitor, but I think there's probably a computer attached to it, mm-hmm. it can probably deliver a very, very rich experience given the amount of memory, the amount of storage that's in it. And I think rather than arguing thick or thin, we should just simply argue what matters, meaning is it appliance-like in the way that we manage it? I don't think people would mind very, very quote-unquote thick, capable devices as long as they're very, very easy to manage, as long as things are treated as being cached and replicated mm-hmm. as opposed to worrying, am I going to have big problems if it gets damaged, if it gets lost? Do I have the choice of picking up another device and using it and buying a more up-to-date version? How much hassle is it going to be to get it from this kind of a device to that kind of a device? If everything was easy to manage, I don't think we would be having a thick versus thin debate. The browser itself, people forget that the browser itself runs client code. It's JavaScript, but it comes down to the client and it gets cached. There's nothing that says that machine language can't be just as lightweight as JavaScript if it were run in a protected runtime, if it were cached the same way that JavaScript is cached, and so on.
Very cool. We have a question from a student from MS PacWest ADE. If I am a student developer, why should I be interested in learning about Windows Azure?
Because you're at the beginning of your career, and when you're at the beginning of your career, you begin looking at assessing the environment the way it is at that moment in time and trying to understand what are the next bets, what are the things that I should learn that are going to give me the greatest opportunity moving forward. Right now, I think everyone should be interested in learning about Windows Azure, but at any given point in time, we are the collection of the experiences that we've learned up to a certain point in time, and at that point, we want to learn about things moving forward, but we also want to leverage the things that we've learned at the past. It's got to be tremendously exciting, just coming out of school right now, learning about, the different programming models that are available. On the client, there are increasingly, we're going from multi-core to many-core, symmetric and asymmetric, computing architectures on the client. On the server side, there is Azure, there is EC2, there are different ways of programming that people haven't programmed in the past, and I'm not sure about people here, but I enjoy software because if you can imagine something, you can just, if you understand the tools that are ahead of you, you can build it, you can play with it, you can mold it and shape it into anything. And I started in electrical engineering, and if you made a mistake in designing something, it would cost me real money. I'd burn things out and I'd have to buy new parts. And software, it's just like, it's the ultimate pliable medium. You can mess around with it and turn it into anything. And Azure is an amazingly enjoyable sandbox to play in because you have all of these machines at your disposal. It's just, it's a lot of fun.
It's really interesting. Probably just literally 5 minutes before we came up on stage, I ran into an old high school friend. Mm-hmm. His name's Jordan Breckenridge, and he's here as an attendee, and it was just a complete chance. We haven't seen each other since high school. And we taught each other assembler on a Commodore 64 back in the day, and that was really when I really was starting to get into programming. And I still think fondly back to that, and I actually, it's kind of a weird thing, I try to remember memory addresses back in the day about different things that you'd peek and poke. Back to you, let's talk about back when you were writing code much more back then. What's some of the more memorable things of code that you've written that you still kind of, you think back to?
I don't know, how much time you got,
Pick one.
Yeah. I mean, when I started programming, I was in high school, Bill Gates and I, had a certain parallel experience in some way because both as freshmen in high school, we both had access to a teletype in our high schools where the faculty really didn't understand how to use it. And so more or less they were asking for guinea pigs to come in and experiment with these things. And for me it was BASIC and Fortran, and we began to experiment and figure out. I think I wrote my first program was a draft lottery program because this was in the days of the draft, and various people would were always nervous the next month when the numbers came out, what was it going to be like? But the really cool thing about being in software, in technology, is that it's very predictable. Technology will just keep getting better and better and better, and we, in our industry, think of things as step functions. There's the mainframe era, the mini computer era, the PC era, but that's not how it is. It's just steady. Things keep improving, and we're very excited about cloud computing right now. It's wonderful, but there's going to be another era beyond cloud computing. And there's another era, you know, beyond the phone and devices. You know, we shouldn't be surprised when someday, oh my gosh, we're actually able to run apps on our TV. You know, it could actually happen. You know, all of these things are relatively easily predictable if you just step back, step away from it for a moment, and try to think, you know, look at the patterns of the past and try to project them moving forward. And that's what makes it such a fun industry.
Let's take another question from Twitter. Panes of glass. How important is it to bring in the PHP, Ruby, and all devs into the Azure ecosystem? And what steps are you taking to reach out?
Well, we believe that Azure is a great environment for all kinds of development. I mean, on Windows Server, there are many, many different layers of software in the stack that people build up. You know, some people like to put labels on different layers of software, like apps or middleware or frameworks or runtimes. But there are many, any sophisticated app is a composite of all sorts of different components. And most developers don't write their entire app soup to nuts. So everyone stands on the shoulder of someone else. So with Windows Azure, we built what we kind of refer to as a cloud OS. It's a general OS layer, and we provide certain facilities at the storage layer, at the database layer. But above that, it's up to everyone. It's up to people who are watching. It's up to people in this room. Some people will build some subsystems. Other people will want to use those subsystems. And unless we have an open environment and embrace every runtime that we possibly can, we're going to be leaving out some developers, and we don't want to do that. We'd like to have it be an open environment for innovation.
Great. So Factonomy. Are we always online or sometimes offline in the future? How do you see this changing not changing?
Yeah, we're always going to be. I don't like to use the word offline, but we're going to have variable connectivity, I think, forever. I mean, I think whether it's zipping through tunnels or being in a rural area or being on a beach somewhere or being in a building that happens to be acting like a Faraday cage, or maybe even being in a concert hall where maybe someday or in some countries, they'll allow jamming, to keep people from disturbing one another. It'll always be a world of somewhat variable connectivity, and as such, I think the different apps and solutions that we have will be agile based on the usage scenarios. So some things don't make sense to use in an offline fashion. Some things are very asynchronous, like notifications can come in quite nicely asynchronously, and you build notification subsystems to reduce the statistical density of interruption, and those things can operate very, very easily in an asynchronous manner. So I think over time it just depends on the app. It just it's look at the app. Media apps. A while ago, I would have said, no, you'd have to bring this whole thing offline. Nowadays, it's amazing. You look at what can be done with Silverlight and how beautiful the experience is live. For a lot of those experiences, you don't really need to take it offline. But for example, writing, I like to personally disconnect. When I used to code, I had this, I called it a 4-hour rule. Some people call it a 3-hour rule. But you just shut down all interruptions because you're dangerous when you're coding, if you're mm-hmm. being interrupted. Similarly, if I'm writing a document about a strategy or something, I like to shut things off, and I like those editors to work offline. It just depends on the app.
I do the same thing with email now, where I'll take my email client and I'll actually take it Outlook and I'll take it to offline.
Yeah.
Because then you don't have the distractions of things coming in at the top, and you can just go and deal with with what's coming in. And it makes it, it just avoids that randomization. Mm-hmm. Jay Hoshi, what is the significance of Dallas to developers?
I think to developers, the real significance, it's actually at various layers. It enables you to discover what data is out there. So there may be data sets that are available that you might not even know are there. Some might be public domain, some might be low cost, some might be expensive, but it lets you discover. Once you discover, it lets you bind to that data in a very uniform, very easy manner. It lets you weave it into your code very easily. Over time, it'll let you join that data with other people's data sets very, very easily. And ultimately, if you want to deploy it in an application, you know, after experimenting with it, it promises to, in essence, have a uniform licensing model so that you aren't stuck in a situation where you want to join two pieces of data, but one has per user licensing and another one has per enterprise licensing or per organization. Each one of those is introduces some level of friction, and just, you know, in essence, by introducing constraints to the provider of the data, it removes constraints for the consumer of the data. And right now, it's kind of the inverse of that. Right now, it's much harder to be the developer trying to consume the data than it is to be the producer.
This is a question that I get asked often when working at Microsoft, and people always ask me to try and ask this of people at our company. You get a lot of mail during the day.
Yes, I do.
How do you, any tips for kind of managing that information flow and how best to be able to deal with the amount of mail that you would receive?
You know, it's hard to make generalizations of that because it depends on what your day is like. My day was a lot different when I wrote code than my day is now. My day now is chopped up into 15 or 30 minute increments for meetings, and it's a very different environment than the one whereas when I said, I did things in 3 or 4 hour increments. Today, what I do is I just do wicked triage. Mm-hmm. I am continuously triaging my email, between this meeting and that meeting. You know, as I'm walking down the hall, I'm just quickly scanning, through my email. Can I get rid of that one? Can I read that? Can I read that? Flag that one for mm-hmm. follow-up. And I'm just, constantly doing that. I've even experimented with smaller devices. There was this thing called an HTC Advantage that I was using for quite a while that was more socially... it was friendlier than sitting in a meeting with a laptop, which is kind of unfriendly to the person that you're trying to meet with. It was more glanceable UI, smaller, that I could kind of, multitask without being rude to
It's not like you're in the meeting with the laptop, look like you're looking at mail, but you don't get busted on it. That's a great device.
You don't get busted.
So this has been great having you on here. Thanks for coming on Channel 9 Live, and look forward to a great PDC.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.